Hello from Patricia Glynn and Storycatcher. Simple stories, simply told. This is Inspirations, conversations with people who are living big and asking the big questions. Hello again and welcome to a Storycatcher edition from the Waterberg, a mountain massif in Limpopo, which is as beautiful as it is fascinating. And the man whose name is associated with this area more than any other is Clive Walker. He's devoted several decades of his life to the rehabilitation and protection of the Waterberg's waterways and land. He has educated hundreds of thousands of people, principally children, about the fragility of the ecological systems, both here and elsewhere in the world. He was hugely instrumental in getting the Waterberg declared a UNESCO Biosphere Reserve. He's an artist, a writer, and a photographer, and was once referred to as a serial founder on account of the number of trusts, foundations, and societies he set up to protect our fauna and flora. So Clive is the obvious choice for this month's Inspirations feature, but I asked him please to tell us stories from his long and rich life. We chatted in the large dining room of his conference center come museum, and you'll hear the autumnal leaves tinkling on its metal roof. Like many conservationists, Clive was a hunter in his early life, albeit briefly, and the story he started with was going on his first hunt with a German professional hunter called Hans Bufer.
He was one of those old, traditional Austrian-German-type hunters that didn't go out for the mere lust of killing something. It was a whole ritual that went with it. And he arranged for me to accompany him to Portuguese East Africa, today Mozambique. And in due course, I set out with him and two other hunters who were more meat hunters than big game. But Hans Bufer was an elephant hunter. So I was loaned a heavy elephant gun. And we were there. We had a concession for 2 weeks. I was 19. And he was well into his 50s by that stage, 55, 60 maybe. And we had two Shangaan trackers. And the Shangaan trackers is what attracted me. And these Shangaans actually were the ones that enabled him and me to eventually shoot an elephant. Of course, one is very excited. And from his point of view, he would sell the ivory. I would have kept it, because I never intended to ever be in the business of shooting something out of pleasure and then selling the ivory. But a lot of these old-timers did that in order to pay for their hobby, if I could call it. He wasn't a professional. After I had studied art for a while, I left for England in 1959. As a lot of young South Africans were doing, we are part of the Commonwealth. And I eventually ended up in the Museum of Natural History because I was staying in Earl's Court. And I entered the museum, and in the main foyer, this is a long time ago now, we talk about 1959, there were three mounted elephants, complete mounted African elephants. And these elephants were obviously stationary, but they're full mount. And I stood before one of them at close range. I was not more than 4 or 5 feet away. And I actually could not believe that I would ever want to shoot one of these. And it was quite a revelation. And I thought, what on earth ever possessed me to want to get an elephant's tail or hairs or a tusk of one of these things? And I said, I'm never ever going to get involved in that. Little did I realize that I eventually would become a game ranger, and part of my job was to put elephants out of their misery if they had been injured badly. But then you're doing something out of compassion and to release, You're not doing it out of pleasure. And from that day onwards, I put away my guns that I had collected. And I thought, no, there's got to be more to just collecting some hair and teeth. Because tusks are, in fact, upper incisors. And I gave it up completely.
But in those days, for a young person interested in the wild and its creatures, there was nowhere else to go to find like-minded people other than the Wildlife Society.
I joined the society because I wanted to get involved in doing something. I just didn't want to be a paying member and get the magazine.
But tell us that story, because you had to knock on their door with a lot of force.
I really did. I went on a number. They used to run these wonderful excursions into the Magaliesberg and all over the place. And I just couldn't relate to these people. It was a very close society. You had to be introduced and you had to have an uncle who was a bird watcher or something like that. And I never realized at the time that later it would have such an effect on me that I actually, believe it or not, I mean, I often wonder whatever made me think as an artist, as a trained artist, that I should ever compete with trained scientists in the field of nature conservation.
You thought, well, I'm going to draw a couple of cheetah.
I'll tell you the story how that came about. Before I actually got to painting the cheetahs, I was invited because by this stage I had started to develop as a wildlife artist. I always wanted to paint wildlife. And I was invited through Ian Player and Barry Clements to attend a hunters convention in San Antonio, Texas in 1973. But with me and about 25 other, mainly American artists, but some very highly regarded British artist was David Shepherd. And David had painted a picture of a beautiful picture of a very angry Bengal tiger. And he told us this funny story one night. He said, you won't believe this, I traveled all the way to India to actually photograph them in the wilds, and they couldn't find a tiger for me. That's how bad it was then. And he said, if it hadn't have been for a friend of mine who was the owner of the Bristol Zoo in London, who had tigers, I was able to go there and with my little Donald Duck camera, I took a happy snap of this Bengal tiger, painted the picture of it. We had 300 prints produced, and they sold then, all those years ago, at 50 years ago, at $100 a piece, signed, limited edition of number three. And this was a wonderful amount of money that went to this organization. And I thought, I've knocked on doors in South Africa to try and get into conservation. I'm going to see if I can do it through art. And then I think why the cheetah came into it, I had this passion for, since I was a nine-year-old, of going to the old library in downtown Johannesburg. And on my way back to the car, I went via Diagonal Street. And there was this open-fronted shop with five cheetah skins hanging like blankets right at the front of the store. And I thought to myself, but surely this is not right. I mean, aren't cheetahs perhaps threatened? I'd never seen one. Never. I'd been to the Kruger Park with Mom and Gran, but we'd never seen a cheetah. And I went in and spoke to the man. He was very kind. And I said, are you able to get these? And where do you get them? He said, no, we get them in the Western Transvaal. It was Transvaal then. Mm. And people buy them. And I said, gee, that's interesting. Anyway, I left it at that. I took a photograph. I've got the photograph to this day. Oh. And from the photograph, I constructed two cheetah standing one behind the other from cheetah that I photographed in Johannesburg Zoo and
good
then sketched them.
Lord, really?
Yeah. And I had a printer friend and he said, I can help you. We could do the same as David Shepherd and we could raise quite a bit of money. We printed 250 copies, 25 rand a copy, and it hit the newspapers with this picture of Diagonal Street, and I'd done a little bit of research to find out that the cheetahs were very, very rare. And it caught the public's imagination. Here I can, for 25 rand, acquire a limited edition signed print, which I know is going to go to a good cause. And I mean, it's peanuts compared to what it is today, 25 rand. I mean, you can't even buy a Guinness for 25
rand. You would know. Clive still has that life-changing photo of the cheetah in the Mooty Market, and he has given it to me to use in the photo pack that accompanies this podcast, along with several more from his long life as a wildlife warrior. But Clive's efforts to get his money to work towards what he wanted proved to be tricky. Friends tried to persuade him to donate the money to existing environmental organizations like the Wildlife Society and the Wilderness Foundation. He, though, wanted it to be used for a very particular cause, wild animals that were in crisis.
About 2 weeks later, by absolute chance, I ended up sitting next to what turned out to be Professor Kobus Bockmer from the University of Pretoria, the Eugene Maria Chair of Wildlife Management. And we got chatting, and then tea, and then the lunch break, and then we got even more chatty. And I eventually told him what I had done. And I said, would you by chance have a graduate or undergraduate doing perhaps an honours who would be interested in doing a survey to determine what is the status of cheetah in South Africa? And of course, he almost hugged me to death on the. He couldn't believe it. He said, you know, really, does anybody ever come and offer? I said, I've got enough money to pay for the student for 1 year, but I'll do my best to raise it higher so we can continue to keep him there for minimum of 2 years. That's what led to the founding of the Endangered Wildlife Trust. And out of those humble beginnings with a part-time one morning secretary in a grubby little office in Bromfontein, the EWT started. And it's interesting, Patricia, that all these years later, the Endangered Wildlife Trust and others are still involved deeply in the conservation of the cheetah.
Despite their best efforts, cheetah are still classified as vulnerable by the IUCN, the International Union for Conservation of Nature. This as a result of a cluster of issues that we have come to know so well. Habitat loss, game fences which fragment their ranges, their perceived threat to livestock, and being targeted for their pelts and bones. Clive left the EWT after 13 years to pursue other environmental interests that were close to his heart, and the closest of these was walking in the wild and the deep transformation it can bring to those who do it in a way that is simple and Spartan.
My abiding passion went back to Ian Player's Wilderness Leadership School, where
you'd have had another epiphany on one
where
of his walks.
Don Richard had said to me, can't you go back to the Transvaal and find somebody who would be prepared to allow you to run weekend trails to begin with young schoolboys and schoolgirls?
Don Richards was another doyen of Southern African environmental education, and he co-authored one of Clive's many books, Walk Through the Wilderness.
Don had this strong belief that we need to get at kids that are 9 years old. It's an impressionable age, and you can do so much and encourage them, and they, who knows, could become. I never had that when I was at school. In my day, nobody knew what the word ecology was at boarding school. We were there to get an education and get kicked occasionally by a horse.
But where to take the kids for this life-changing experience? The hunt began and eventually brought Clive to this exquisitely beautiful place called the Waterberg. In northern Sotho, the area is known as Tabametse, a direct equivalent of Water Mountain in Afrikaans. Wherever you go in the Waterberg, you walk on ancient soil, on ancient rocks. The mountain itself is about 1.8 billion years old. The presence of the past is manifest everywhere, and the spectral presence of earlier creatures that I sense so sharply here is probably part of what made Clive choose this area for initiating young people into the mysteries of the African bush. This mountainous UNESCO biosphere reserve has mostly been restored to what it was like some 2,000 years ago when sand bushmen first entered the area. These spiritually alert people responded then, as Clive did now, to the almost mystical beauty of the Waterberg, creating rock art of lyrical beauty, paintings of rhinoceros and kudu, fleet-footed hunters, and strange hybrid creatures, half animal, half human. Middle Stone Age people also inhabited the Waterberg, using it as a refuge. The mountainous terrain was difficult for their enemies to penetrate, and the relics of dry stone forts still exist, attributed to the Nguni people, who arrived in about 1300. A couple of happy coincidences led Clive to a farm in the Waterberg owned by retired Kenyan hunter Eric Rundgren. Eric was notorious among clients and fellow hunters in Nairobi as a giant who gazed cynically at the world from heavy-hooded Nordic blue eyes. Blunt, straight-talking, Rundgren was affectionately dubbed the Maharaja of Mayhem.
He couldn't leave the veranda. He sat permanently in a chair, but his young son, David, popped us into an old, clapped-out compi, the door missing, and we all piled in. And he said, "I'm taking you to one spot which I think you'll really enjoy." And we drove up into the hills opposite from where their home was in the valley. And we walked for 100 meters through fairly dense bush. And we came to this magnificent cliff, which I was to learn was called Lepetedi. Lepetedi is the blue-headed agama lizard that we get here. And below us, stretching for maybe 15 kilometers as far as I could see, was the silver winding river, which went right down below us in these steep cliffs and then disappeared off to the left into the rest of the mountain range. And I just said, "I've arrived." I just knew it.
Veteran East African hunter and fellow of the Royal Geographical Society, Owen Letcher, wrote only two books, one of which, The Bonds of Africa, was published in 1913. In the preface, Letcher writes, "I have endeavoured to place on record some of my wanderings, to describe the wondrous beauties, scenes of savagery and wild beasts that are still the treasures of the lost continent." But this is a little misleading. Deep beneath Letcher's slightly stilted writing pulses the heart of a man in love. Many of the old-timers acknowledged that Africa could ruthlessly take hold of sensitive people, enchant them, enslave them, addict them, and never let them go. As Dennis Finch Hatton, lover of Karen Blixen, is reported to have said, "In Africa, more than malaria gets into your blood, you know." And this is clearly what happened to Clive Walker when he looked down at the view from high up on Lepetedi. Just one glimpse of a silver river or a pale savanna dotted with thorn trees or a towering krantz or a silent ancient baobab, and one's heart turns head over heels with devotion. It happened to me. We are all Africa addicts.
And I said, "I don't need to see anything else." I said, "You know, if your dad's interested in something, can we go back and talk?" Anyway, we went down and we had lunch and we had a tea. And he was straight with me. He said, "Look, I'm not interested in you walking around here with a whole lot of kids." Blunt like that. He was a holy terror, this man. Tough. But he got on with me, and he hated the lawyer because he distrusted lawyers. But he liked me because I knew every time he talked about a gun and a certain caliber which was capable of killing this or that, I knew it or I had one. And he took a liking to me just simply because I'd had some hunting experience. And I think he still thought I was a bit of a Johannesburg kind of idiot. And he said, Clive, I'm not interested in you wandering around here with a whole lot of kids and your friends. I'm prepared to give you an option for 3 months to buy this place. And you're involved in the Endangered Wildlife Trust. You seem to be able to raise a lot of money. You go out and raise it, and this place is yours. There's nothing here that's going to outwardly harm anybody because we don't have anything.
But you mean we have an animal nest?
We have a river that you could drink the water out of. I mean, that in itself. How many kids are swimming in a river, a natural river? And he said, I'll give you 3 months. Anyway, the lawyer was chirping there, you know, how they want to get to. Anyway, he said, I'm not changing my mind. You go away. I'll do nothing. I'll put all the brakes on selling it.
Well, you know how the story ends. Clive found the money and the wealthy friend who bought the land, Dale Parker, went into partnership with Clive in the endeavour for which he will be principally remembered.
I got my chance to set up an environmental school, and Dale got what he had always dreamed of one day owning his own game farm. Dale never had any interest in tourism. His passion was to conserve that part of the Waterberg.
They called it Lapalala. The word comes from the Sotho word lepalale, which means one that inundates, probably a reference to the water-rich Waterberg and its myriad springs. The area that Clive and Dale bought was 5,000 hectares in extent and was the perfect place to teach those 9-year-old boys and girls the secrets, precautions and safety protocols of the African wilderness.
It was very simple. It had 4 little rustic bush camps, which Kadita took over and started self-catering with families. And then the history is that he could not resist buying the next door farm. I used to go in there on my own and trespass and find crimson-breasted shrikes and tell him that it's full of crimson-breasted shrikes next door. And he said, but why aren't they here? I said, I don't know. When it came up for sale, he bought it. But and we had a wonderful relationship until he died 20 years later.
Nowadays, Lapalala covers 48,000 hectares of the Waterberg, at least 85% of which is reclaimed farmland. In time, an environmental school was built, which has now seen 600,000 youngsters pass through its doors, some of whom have gone on to make the wild their home and their business.
I think Dale was a visionary in that he didn't go for the big and the hairy. He wasn't attracted by, I can bring elephants in or even rhinos. He didn't really go out of his way to do that. He wanted to conserve the aquatic system and plants and everything that goes with it.
There was no big game on Lapalala in the beginning, as Clive says, but eventually the two of them started reintroducing elephant, hippo and rhino. I say reintroducing, but that makes it sound measured and scientific. It wasn't at all.
Dale and I decided we had too many wildebeest and we needed to get rid of them. And who would like to buy them? Dale didn't like the thought of them going off and being hunted. So he was a bit choosy. I met up with a game dealer and he said, look, instead of me buying these wildebeest, why don't you come and see the hippos I got? I said, what do you mean hippos you got? Now, you see this, I got 5 hippos. They come from 2 zoos in the United States. I said, what? He said, yes, they were brought out as deck cargo. And they had to be hosed down every few hours on the ship from America with fresh water and not salt water. And they're as fit as fiddles, and they're in my swimming pool. I said, what?
In Bruderstrom.
This is in Bruderstrom. There they are. And I get down there. There these 5 heads are looking at me. And they're little hippos. They're not big things. I know what a big hippo is. I've been attacked in a canoe by a hippo, a bit off the back of the canoe. I know how big that can be at that range. I mean, you can almost smell his breath at a meter behind you. And I said, what on earth are you doing with these? He said, I've acquired them from these zoos, and I would like to see them go back. I said, we've got the perfect place for these hippos. I said, why don't we swap the wildebeest for the hippos? He said, you got a deal. The next thing is I had a pyrotechnician arrive with five little hippos. And Dale was beside himself. And he said, this is it. This is why I'm here. And we released them into this huge dam, not on the main river, but on a side dam in a beautiful location. And we had to get them off artificial food and get them to take on the natural vegetation, which took 4 or 5 months. But they settled in beautifully. And having done this, I had built up quite a relationship with the Natal Parks Board over rhinos. And the chief game capture officer phoned me up and said, look, I've got a delinquent bull hippo that we've had to take out of Lake St. Lucia. And we got a female from Makuzi. Would you like to buy them? And they're this price. So I got hold of Dale and said, I've got another two, but this time they're adults. And I said, I suggest we put them in the Palala River and not with our little family, because they might end up killing each other. And Dale said, go for it. So the next thing is a big rhino truck arrives with this massive hippo bull, beautiful, and an adult female. And we open the doors and we let them into this big, huge pool. Hippos today occupy all the river system.
Mm.
They eventually met up with that mob down there.
The little ones.
And that in turn led to us having to rescue a little baby hippo.
I was about to say, did your lovely wife, Conita, not rescue it?
And one day we got a radio call to say they found a hippo and it's been chewed to pieces. It had big teeth marks all over its back. It was about this size.
That's about 2 feet.
Yeah. And they brought this hippo in because it was wandering around in the bush. And Conita raised that hippo. We built a swimming pool in the backyard, a little small swimming pool. And it lived in Kenita's laundry at night in a dog basket. And Conita, with the help of Corin Trendler, managed to get the correct lactose-type milk. And she just applied a mother instinct to this baby hippo and raised it to adulthood in our back garden. It hated men. A woman could go up to it and you could put your arms around it. But if Dale or I arrived and parked the car in front of the house, it would run from one side of the garden to the other after us. And we eventually had to put tannulith poles around our veranda to keep her off the veranda that we could dive under when we were running from where the car was parked because she was after us. Now that female, Conita, released freely into the Palala River. And she's part of the progeny that have provided hippos up and down the river system. But Dale used to love going down and helping with the feeding of these hippos. And I've got pictures of him standing there with all five hippos ignoring him completely. And that is just the most lovely story because they came out of captive bred hippos in zoos where they'd probably been taken from Kenya. Because I don't think they did that in South Africa in those days. Certainly didn't sell hippos to zoos. And now they've been brought back.
It must be deeply rewarding.
And you know, the benefits that a hippo brings back to a river system with its nutrients in its dung is just incredible for fish life.
No one forgets
that. So there's
that.
A whole system at work.
But haven't you then prevented your kids from swimming in the river?
We don't allow swimming at all because our crocodile population, which had been very heavily reduced, I suspect shot. And now with flying, when Anton did a lot of the aerial surveys, some of them are 8 feet long. So none of us go anywhere near the rivers.
Then there was the introduction, or should I say reintroduction, of elephant to the reserve. They'd been in the Waterberg for centuries and are pictured in some of the rock art in the caves and overhangs of the area. It was not an easy decision because Clive was running wilderness trails, but having spent many years of his life helping to conserve elephant, He found the thought of having them roaming around his beloved Lapalala irresistible.
I have seen the elephant paintings, and having this love of elephants, I thought, wouldn't it be quite something? And I'm going against what I originally said, being in an area where you don't have anything like that that's going to cause you harm. But Lapalala in those days was divided. The one area was the bush camps and the school, and the other area was where the rhinos were, and I'd hoped that we could put a couple of elephants in there. Anyway, the same man who provided and encouraged me to take the hippos told me that he had three elephants. These elephants go back to about 87. No, it was even earlier than that. I had been invited to Zimbabwe to go on a culling operation. And out of that, five of them were rescued. They were tied up with ropes and nets.
Was that the intention, to keep some of the youngsters?
Keep the young and sell them to zoos. Mm. They had that policy there. Mm. The rest were all shot. If the elephant was too big or too small, they put it out immediately. But anyway, Rambo, Rogan, and Rachel were part of one of these culling operations. I don't think it was the one that I was on. But they ended up in John's place. And John?
John?
The owner of the capture operation in Johannesburg, or Bredestrom. He and his wife, particularly his wife, could not bring themselves to sell them to a zoo. He didn't mind selling antelope to zoos, but they didn't. They had become so attached to these. But they were taking up a huge area. They had a wonderful enclosure, and they eat a lot.
A lot.
And he said to me, my wife wants to donate them to you, if you can get permission to bring them to Lapalala. So I get hold of Dale. And Dale said, Clive, I'm not altogether sure I think it's the right thing to do, but if you want to do it and it doesn't cost us any money at all, then try it out. But the Nature Conservation Division said, I have to electrify. But I said, these elephants are so calm and so tame. They're never going to break down because the entire area, 10,000 hectares, was completely fenced. Anyway, they came up. And I got pressurized that I have to electrify. And it just was so expensive. With no guarantee that it would work. It was really early stages. Anyway, I reluctantly gave them up, and the van came back up again and took them all in, put them down, took them down. They were very successful in getting them into a decent reserve in KwaZulu-Natal. And from there, they moved to one or two other locations.
Because they were troublemakers?
No. One was a troublemaker. He kept breaking out. And they, in the end, he was destroyed. But Rambo and Rachel survived. But Rogan had to be put down. He never got over the trauma of what he went through. Just didn't. Mm. I think we have to be sensitive to that. Mm. They're very sensitive creatures. Anyway, they eventually arrived in their final home where they have grown up. And in November last year, I was paging through Facebook. And here was a series of three photographs of this magnificent bull elephant with huge tusks crossed like this. And a female elephant, and his name was Rambo. And the female's name was Rachel.
Rachel.
But there was no Rogan. And I got hold of the lady in charge of this reserve. And I said, can you give me the background? And she said, yes. And she told me they had not always belonged to them. But they rescued them in the end, and it's their final home, and they are free.
And they huge.
Free. And huge, full grown. I mean, it's 30 years. That's quite a... So they're at least 35 or 40 years. And here I'm looking at this elephant. I said, there's absolutely no way. And it's turned out that it's our original Rogan and Rachel. And they're living wonderfully free. But the most magnificent, huge bull elephant, completely tame.
There are many more elephants, thousands of them, that Clive has saved over the course of his life as a conservationist and activist. Not just elephants either. There are rehabbed rhino, the rescued hippo, his intense devotion to the bush in the wildest sense, insects, trees, birds, grass, the list goes on.
There's just something about elephants that actually move us in a way. They're bigger than us. They're dangerous. They're clever. They're intelligent. They are like us as family. And there's a lot about elephants that we don't know. I would venture to suggest that even now we don't know about elephants. Mm. And I've painted them all my life. And I have tried my best in three or four places to improve the life of elephants in the areas that they live. And I'm happy to say that they are far better off today than they were in 1973, when poaching of elephants was enormous. But I think elephants shaped my life and my interest in conservation. And the Wildlife Society, I loved the idea of looking at butterflies and what's in the river and all this, but I yearned to sort of get in amongst where the stuff could really scare the daylights out of you. And I have been scared to death. I think the fact that I can't walk very well these days at my age has a lot to do with running away from elephants. Far better to run away from an elephant to try and confront it.
And we end with the story of what really happened to Clive's legs, such that he's unable to walk comfortably now. And it has very little to do with running away from elephants.
Before I entered into being a game rancher, I was in the art world. I took up a flying instruction at Rand Airport to become a private pilot, never thinking that one day I'd spend 20 years flying in aeroplanes. But I thought, I need to do something. I'm not in wildlife, but I might as well get a private pilot's license. I was never a good pilot. I just don't concentrate sufficiently to be seriously minded. My son, Anton, is an outstanding pilot. But I couldn't find my way back home if I got lost out in the Mahalisburgs. Anyway, I qualified as a pilot. And we used to have these passing out parades where we would each get our wings as pilots. When the wings party came, we'd had a tremendous party at the club. And the club was like this. It was a single-story building. It used to be the old Air Force officers' mess during the Second World War. They had a squadron base there. And it's low corrugated iron, huge big structure. Today it's a museum, an Air Force museum. And one thing led to another, and we all ended up drinking far too much beer. And I don't know what possessed me, but together with somebody else, I ended up on the roof of the clubhouse with a Castle Brewery's umbrella, garden umbrella. And the bet was to see how far you could run down the roof and then go off the end with the umbrella to see how far you could get. Well, the man who had been with me when we crashed in the Tiger Moth went first. And he was short and small and not very heavy. And he did it perfectly. He sailed off the end of the roof with this umbrella and landed and that. But I then ran down the roof and the umbrella folded backwards. And I landed in the rockery, not in the grassy verge, breaking both ankles. Carted off to the hospital in Germiston. And the nurse who could, I think, say, listen, what have you guys been doing? We said, we're from the flying club. She thought, I might have guessed. And it's finally caught up with me now. I don't want to resign myself to a wheelchair, so I have a wheeler. I have taken up Tai Chi, which is very much about deep, proper breathing.
Oh, says I to Clive, you've got Tai Chi instructors out here in the Waterberg? No, he says, I get it on YouTube.
I do. That's I sit there watching and then I'm practicing myself.
Clive never stops learning, never lets the old man in, as Clint Eastwood put it. I know this because Clive kindly gave me space on his farm to park Alexandra my truck while I explore the Waterberg. So I've seen him every day for about a week now. He's about to turn 89, but he is fully engaged in life and his creative pursuits. He's about to bring out another book, this one about the Thule block, and knowing him, he's probably got yet another up his sleeve. My thanks to Clive for showing us just how much commitment can achieve.